Hello and welcome to the Oxford Ukraine Hub podcast, a series of podcasts brought to you from the University of Oxford. The Oxford Ukraine Hub is an interdisciplinary network connecting expertise across the University of Oxford with international researchers and practitioners working on Ukraine-related issues. By placing Ukraine at the center of scholarly inquiry, we aim to disrupt long-established epistemological hierarchies within Slavic and East European studies. Our podcast series brings together diverse voices and perspectives to explore Ukraine's past, present, and future through various disciplinary lenses. In 2025 and 2026, we are running a series of seminars. Today's episode features two panelists from our inaugural seminar, Ukraine Environmentalisms: Perspective from Science, Policy, and Culture. I am Evgenia Kapitsa, an Associate Professor of Environmental, Climate, and Energy Law, a visiting academic at the University of Oxford, and Maria Curie for Ukraine Research Fellow. Today, we are honored to be joined by two distinguished guests from our science and policy panel. Dr. Svetlana Krakowska, a renowned climate scientist and Ukraine's representative to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And Anna Kerman, a leading environmental policy expert and advocate for sustainable energy in Ukraine. As we know, Ukraine faces unprecedented environmental challenges. Beyond being the breadbasket of Europe, it's home to diverse ecosystems from the Polesia wetlands to the Carpathian Mountains. Today, with nearly a third of Ukraine's forests damaged by war, 23 national parks under occupation, and a third of the country is mined, the environmental situation has reached a critical point. We'll explore how climate science, environmental policy, and green reconstruction can help Ukraine not only recover, but potentially emerge as a leader in sustainable development. Svetlana, Anna, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for being here. And thank you so much for finding the time and share your extensive expertise. And I would like to start with Svetlana. And I would like to begin with a broad but very crucial question. From your perspective, what role does Ukraine play in tackling climate change? When we're thinking about regional dimensions, but as well globally.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us and for inviting. When we think about climate action, actually, Ukraine might not be the first country to come to mind, but it's actually made some big moves in the fight against climate change in recent decades. First of all, Ukraine is fully committed to international climate efforts. It's a signatory of the Paris Agreement, and it has pledged to cut greenhouse gases emissions at least 65% by 2030, with a long-term goal of reaching climate neutrality by 2060 first, but now country works toward alignment with EU goal of climate neutrality before middle of the 21st century. And that's not a small feat for a country that has historically relied on heavy industry and fossil fuels and was in the top 10 emitters in 1990. Now, one of the key areas where Ukraine is making a difference is renewable energy. Before the war, it rapidly increased its solar and wind power capacity. And even though the energy infrastructure suffered major setbacks due to the war at the moment, the commitment to a green recovery is stronger than ever. The idea is to rebuild Ukraine's energy sector to be more resilient, modern, and sustainable, moving away from coal and gas towards renewables. Another part of climate actions is adaptation, because that's a huge challenge too. Ukraine is one of the countries who are on front line of climate change, dealing with much faster rising air temperatures than the global mean, increasing droughts and changing rainfall patterns. And agriculture is ultimately one of the most important economic sectors, and Ukraine is one of the world's biggest food producers. Therefore, climate smart farming is becoming a priority. The focus is on reducing soil degradation, improving irrigation and water management overall, and using sustainable land management practices to ensure food security while cutting emissions. And at regional level, Ukraine is aligning with the EU Green Deal and working closely with European partners on clean energy, again, projects, working with the EU Energy Community Treaty to transition away from coal and expand wind and solar power across Eastern Europe. Despite the ongoing war, it's staying engaged in climate diplomacy, pushing for stronger policies and environmental accountability, including holding Russia responsible for the massive environmental destruction caused by the war. Ukraine has positioned itself as a key player in regional and global climate action, despite the immense challenges it faces. So, bottom line, Ukraine might be facing enormous challenges right now, but it's also positioning itself as a key player in the global climate movement. And if it can achieve a green recovery, it could set an example for other countries dealing with post-crisis rebuilding.
Wow, that's actually fascinating to hear. And the inspiration of Ukraine to not only to build back, but build back better and greener, like this concept that has been in mind of many people and policymakers and like Ukrainians, should be grounded on some scientific recent updates, right? And looking as far as like you are a scientist first and foremost, looking at this scientific landscape, how has Ukrainian environmental and climate science evolved in recent years? And particularly when we're talking about the climate change research and possibly biodiversity conservation?
Well, as a scientist, been working in Ukrainian Hydromet Institute for over 30 years, I can say more on climate science. And we now in Ukraine has made major strides adapting this research to both regional and global challenges, in fact. And during this 70-year history, our institute, climate research was one of the priorities and most developed. And in recent decades, we prepared projections of climate change for Ukraine based on different scenarios of socioeconomic world development. And these projections now serve as a basis for further modeling in different sectors like water management, agriculture and forestry, energy generation and consumption in the future warmer climate. Our Hydromet service continues climate monitoring, expand networks with automatic weather station, improve data collection on extreme weather events, and develop early warning system of hazardous events, particularly flood and fire danger. Monitoring of air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions, again, it goes to numerical models and which we analyze and can forecast. So this is another area where we have significant achievements. On the international stage, as you said, actually, I represent Ukraine to Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and there I'm not alone. We have more scientists now, more younger scientists as me, and they do actually well there. They prove their qualification and expertise. So we do really good progress in on climate adaptation and agricultural zones. And this, our research has been used as a model for other nations facing droughts and soil degradation. As an example, I can say about countries of the Central Asia, they took our modeling approach for yield forecast based on biophysical model, which our expert developed in UHMI. One of the most critical aspects of Ukraine's role in commitments to green post-war recovery, it's rebuilding infrastructure with renewable energy and sustainable cities and eco-friendly reconstruction method. This not only aligns with EU climate goals, but sets a precedent how nations can emerge from crisis with a focus on sustainability. On the biodiversity side, I'm not maybe much more informed, but I know that Ukrainian scientists applying AI-driven ecosystem monitoring using satellite data and drones to track species movement, deforestation, and habitat changes in real time. This has been especially useful in conservation efforts for the Carpathian Forest and Black Sea, especially after Kakhovka Dam demolished by terrorist Russian attack. So, despite the challenges posed by war and environmental degradation, Ukraine is pushing forward with a science-led approach to resilience, ensuring that both climate research and conservation efforts continue to evolve and make an impact.
Wow. Thank you very much for sharing these examples that Ukraine, while facing such an enormous challenges, it actually became the hub for innovation and like the cradle for innovative ideas that pop up. And all of these innovative environmental research projects that you mentioned, and more to come, they are offering solutions for the global environmental challenges. And thank you for giving the example of such how Ukraine is not only teaching itself how to respond fast and green and environmentally friendly to its own challenges, but how it teaches other countries how to incorporate the best available technology that's appearing from the response to the adversity. Thank you very much for your insights. And these scientific perspectives are so much crucial when we are talking about Ukraine and its environmental conscious reconstruction. And Anna, I would like now to bring you here and shifting our focus to policy, because like, you know, we always have to communicate science to policymakers, and we should make policymakers understand science as well. And having your expertise in mind, and from your perspective, Ukraine's path towards EU integration, it raises important question about environmental standards that should be grounded on the scientific like outcomes. And how does Ukraine's environmental policy align with, or to what extent it is still different from EU environmental standards? And what challenges are the biggest, what challenges exist in harmonizing these approaches?
Well, thank you for the question, and once more for the invitation. This is a very good question, and also, of course, you know, when you start naming all of the challenges, there is more than a plenty. I think what is important and what is clear is that Ukraine is now definitely moving toward the EU, and not just that it's something that is, you know, of our will, but there is so many stakeholders in Brussels and all over the EU who actually support our integration and who see Ukraine as a very important player in the future of the EU. And I think what is also important is that the largest parliamentary group in Brussels, the EPP, they even have, you know, a hashtag, Ukraine in EU by 2030. And I think having just the date that 2030 is there, even if it may seem to be over-optimistic or anything like this, you know, it's just fantastic just to understand that we are there, we are moving there for sure now, and there is no way back. Unfortunately, this was, you know, and is connected to the very sad circumstances. We are still at war, and the war is bringing more and more losses every day, human losses, but also environmental losses. But this path and understanding that we are not just, you know, a country that wants to become part of the EU, but we are actually, you know, a part of the family. This is the way we feel now, especially as a contrast with Russia. We definitely understand that we belong to Europe, while Russia clearly doesn't, looking at the value. So this is one important point, you know, having this perspective, having this understanding, and having even this year, even though it's not a part of any, you know, memorandums or anything, but just thinking about it and it's been pronounced. Svetlana already mentioned that Ukraine is already looking further in the perspective of 2050. We have now, actually since very recently, we finally have in our legislation the embedded climate neutrality target for Ukraine, which is now 2050. And this is, again, this is important. Before, it was not the case. It had not been the case before autumn last year, where it was different from EU's 2050 target. And even though we have the wartime, but we actually have, you know, the government, the civil society organizations, businesses, actually all of the stakeholders, cities understanding the enormous challenge of becoming part of the EU, of the integrating the standards. We understand, I think, in general, but at the same time, I don't think we understand that we are lacking capacity, and we definitely lack capacity. And I think one of the most important challenges in Ukraine is people. I mean, people, sorry, not just the challenges, people are the challenge, meaning human resource. Everybody is talking a lot about financial resources, which we definitely need to actually implement any standards that we may put into legislation. But then it all starts with people who understand what the e-integration is about. And we definitely will need a few years to, you know, to move on to actually train the people who would be working on first on legislation and then implementation of environmental and climate and all of the other standards. Another big challenge is that the war is still ongoing, and it means that while we are working on the e-integration, Ukraine is working on it. And again, all of the stakeholders try to support each other as much as they can with limited human resources. But then the destruction and devastation is just happening and happening, you know, and dealing with those consequences is that are happening in parallel. It's it's an enormous pressure for this generation, for all the upcoming generations. And of course, the financial resources, I already mentioned that, but that will be a big challenge. And I think I can just give you, because this is now more like a theory, things that I'm saying, but if we take very particular sectors, and even those where Ukraine already, I think, has not too bad standards, that are close to the EU ones in energy and in building sector, Ukraine is doing a very good job. But at the same time, if we actually want to build our new buildings according to the latest European standard, which is called Near Zero Energy Building Standard, so these are already quite autonomous buildings, you know, with a share of renewables that you have, you know, solar panels on the roof, heat pumps, and so on. That costs something. So we, for the moment, we have. During the martial law, as the war is ongoing, we just simply cannot afford straight away this larger cost for new construction that would straight away integrate renewables and all of the good things that we actually are fighting for, and we want them to be there, but because we don't have enough resources. So it's a constant struggle, and this is where it's complicated. And also there is some other sectors of the economy where integrating environmental standards is much more complicated for Ukraine for the moment, but we have to be dealing with that. And this is agriculture, and I think here we'll be having lots of interesting discussions, because our agriculture is very much monopolized, and we have to be thinking about sustainable production of products and of goods, and you know how we actually change this. And also infrastructure. We don't really have good examples in Ukraine for now of green infrastructure, for example, and we would have to be integrating EU standards. And also everything that comes to purely nature protection, biodiversity protection, there is also a lot of work to do there. And this is just a few things to name. But again, I think to once more underline where the main challenges lie, it's the human resources, it's the financial resources, and the fact that we are trying to work on EU integration while we are, you know, fighting the Russian aggression all at the same time.
Yeah, thank you very much for such a comprehensive response. And it's truly what we can say, that reconstruction, it's a lot about both challenges and opportunities, right? And while we have this green and environmentally friendly endeavor in mind, still there is always the biggest challenge how to balance it. And we have on the one hand the economic development concern that Ukraine should be not only rebuilding, but it should be as well like rebuilding like fast, but as well kind of economically profitable, while keeping in mind all of these green standards and EU standards. And this is the huge home task that Ukraine is currently so much successful. At the same time, bumping into many like obstacles like investment constraints and so on. From this regard, do you think possibly like Svetlana, you can share as well any kind of like reflection on that, but like the first would come to Anna, like what do you think, what is one key theme to balance this economic development and green agenda in environmental protection during the reconstruction. Because, like, first and foremost, we have to rebuild, right? And we have to have our economy running. But on the other hand, we have to respond to the EU requirements, and we have to respond to the inner, like, willingness of Ukrainians to live in a safe country, and s ecological safety is one of the key principles. And if we undermine these efforts now, like for the sake of this economic, like, redevelopment, it would not end up the way we would like it to be.
That's one of the key questions, and we've been having the conversations about large-scale reconstruction since 2022. Now we are facing the fact and the reality that reconstruction is happening while the war is ongoing. And we, of course, want to be living in peace, but then, we don't know what the reality would be in the coming years, or even this year, or actually even tomorrow. We are living in the unknown. But then, the reality is that and I think for many it's hard to understand, but we do see this in Ukraine, that environment and climate are not a priority during the wartime, simply because, just look at the budget of the country. Most of the money is definitely going for defense, because this is we're talking about survival, so this is how the country lives. So indeed, environment and climate are not a priority during the wartime. It doesn't mean, though, that nothing is happening. So, of course, what I just explained before, there is actually quite some people who are working on one side EU integration, and at the same time trying to, and this is what we've been doing with many civil society organizations and think tanks, analytical centers from Ukraine, all over Europe. You've been talking about the need for this green and sustainable recovery. But then this becomes an issue, and I think there is a certain contrast to some other countries where you can kind of, when you don't have the war, you can afford to say, well, environment is in the center of all the discussions. So let's say nature is in the center, biodiversity, and you want to protect that, and then people come next, right? In Ukraine, is that the case? And this is the only way to actually explain why we need a more sustainable recovery, is that when we put people in the center, because we want to preserve our people. Because again, we need people. We need people to have the country, and to be on one hand surviving, and at the same time and living, and developing, and also proceeding with all the other things we discussed. So when we look at this more sustainable reconstruction from the people-centered perspective, and what people need today, then certain things just make total sense. And Svetlana already mentioned the energy sector, and how Ukraine is now showing how resilience in the energy sector is looking like during the times of crisis. We have now communities all over Ukraine who want to have renewables locally, small scale, to make sure that if there is any blackouts, if there is any big disruptions, they still have the constant supply of electricity, at least for critical infrastructure, for hospitals, for water supply facilities, for schools, but also for themselves. And we can actually see now solar panels, appearing a bit randomly in some random places, sometimes on the balconies when there is not that much sun, but people just want to have that because they understand this is autonomy. And this is unlike fossil fuel based systems with diesel or something, diesel generators, which also are important actually. But then these eat so much money. You buy a diesel generator, you run it for 2 years, and then you throw it out. And then in these 2 years, you spend so much on the diesel. While when you have a panel and you have the battery, that works for a very long time. So, this is this concept of sustainability and resilience. And I think in Ukraine, we talk a lot about how, resilience is looking like also from climate, environmental perspective. And there's so many things that merge together here. And this is, again, from the perspective of people's needs on the ground. So this is one thing. And at the same time, I think it's also important when we look at the scale of the country. What is, I'm very often asking this question publicly too. How does Ukraine see its economy? Do we still want to say the stay the resource base by the countries and be just exporting the agriculture products or other products? Probably we also want to transform our economy. And transforming the economy toward a more modern based one, that actually means moving together with the EU toward this more green economy, right? A circular economy, where Ukraine could play a role. It could be producing the equipment needed for this energy transition, for example. It could be producing actually everything I just mentioned before, heat pumps or solar panels. Now actually there is a big conversations, of course, about the Ukraine-US deal on critical minerals. What we have to fight for is that when we do look at our future, where the green economy is, is where we're aiming for, then we should not be just talking about, production of critical minerals to then export them abroad, and leaving a huge environmental impact, but using them in Ukraine to produce something locally. Batteries, for example, which Ukraine is already needing aplenty and probably will because energy transition is happening anyway, all over the world. So yeah, this is this is really about looking at the larger picture of where we want to be in the future, and then putting people first and their needs. And I think there is definitely so many things that come together here.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And I think, Svetlana, you have a lot to add on these points, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess what we Ukrainians are different with Russians first. Okay, maybe not first, but one of the difference that they want to go in the past and rebuild USSR, and we look in the future. Actually, we look in the green recovery, in more eco-friendly country, and more cleaner, and our air and water and everything. So I have a lot of Ed, and of course, people are in the center, for sure. But for these people, we need this environment. So we don't want to live just in this cement jungles, let's say. We want again, as I said, for this we, well, I myself, I put solar panels on the roof of our house more than 2 years ago. So because I very, very well recognized that I want to be independent, and of course we were expecting the first winter, these blackouts, and even those seven panels, they even in January they gave opportunity for my family at least to have some light and our charged phones and other gadgets. So it's a lot, in fact. So I can just confirm. And now I see that many my neighbors, they ask about this, so we recognize and we prove that this transformation is more sustainable and more resilient. Well, when we speak about actually this environment recovery, so we understand that we need to balance this science and policy, and they want to go and walk hand in hand. With my knowledge of climate projections, we do this for till the end of the century, in fact. Even and we now absolutely sure and clear that we will have this 1.5 degree scenario, and for this scenario anyway, we will have more extreme events and more biodiversity loss and more droughts and more fires. So anyway, we need to adapt to this, and for even war is ongoing, we need to think on future, and if we build something, we need to have it in our mind, in fact. So this climate smart reconstruction, it's essential. So, and again, I very like one innovative project which actually shows us Ukrainians as a creative nation, in fact. So I was really very much moved with this project which called Minefields Honey, in fact, which turns war-torn land into a source of life. So we already mentioned that almost 30% of Ukraine's territory contaminated with mines, and traditional farming is too dangerous. But this initiative used drones to plant honey flowers, so in these areas, and then bees safely produce honey, which actually goes to jars to our consulates in different countries as present to other countries. So in this case, we can raise awareness and funds for demanding these territories. And it really shows how innovation and resilience can help reclaim our land. It's a powerful symbol of Ukraine's ability to transform destruction into renewal.
Wow, thank you very much for the example of the honey. And we will definitely share like the links with our listeners afterwards. And if to wrap up like quickly this part, so people-centered, resilient Ukraine, right? So this is something that we can continue advocating for. And thank you very much for sharing your perspectives. And we would move on to the next question. And following the next question, I would like to touch on the very strong perspective that emerged actually during our discussions during the seminar, which we had in Oxford, and the current emerging topic that is widely spread within Ukrainian cultural critics. And I would like you both to share your take on the role of fossil fuels in fueling wars, and in particular in fueling fascism in Russia. There is a fantastic Ukrainian filmmaker and critic, Alexei Radinsky, that brought this up, but not only. And Anya, when you were presenting in Oxford at the end of January, you touched a lot upon that. Can you please elaborate a little bit more on how fossil fuels are fueling fascism in Russia? And you had a very interesting perspective for decolonization, and that our dependency on fossil fuels, and particularly Russian fossil fuels, and when I'm talking about Russian dependency, it's like the dependency of European Union. So what is your takeaway, and how did you come up with this idea in your mind?
Well, actually, I have to start by citing Svetlana, who is with us today, but she was the first person back in 22 who clearly said that Russia's aggression against Ukraine is a fossil fuel war. Why is it so? That's simply because almost half of Russia's state budget is coming from the revenues of its fossil fuel exports. So we are not even talking about revenues from production of the fossil fuel, but actually exports to other countries. And we also see and know, and all this, many people think that Russia is just Moscow and St. Petersburg, you know, this richer cities that look great and look like any other big cities around the world, like developed and everything. But we know that many villages and towns all around Russia don't even have access to gas, that Russia is producing plenty, right? So Russia's economy is surviving and living thanks to this production of its fossil fuels, mostly gas and oil, a bit of coal too. I mean, a bit, but from the remembering how large Russia is, geographically speaking. And that means that Russia cannot really exist otherwise than thanks to this very, unfortunately, but they have very rich resources, right? That could still last for decades for sure. But then if we imagine what happens to Russia afterward, because energy transition is something I think clearly unavoidable. So yes, perhaps we are not talking about a complete energy transition to renewables in 10 years, right? It would not be that quick, but with time, and the world is already moving. Now we are somewhere in between where we are catching up. The developing countries are now trying to, you know, there is this race. But in any case, we are moving toward energy transition, decarbonization in the energy sector. The technologies are already there and they make total sense. And as I mentioned, even in reality, just off Ukraine, renewables make sense today. So Russia probably would not be able to survive. And of course, when we talk about production of these fossils around Russia, it means that this production creates local oligarchy groups. So then these richest dictate everything. So what the local economy is looking like, and it's again, it's mostly based on these productions of fossil fuels. And then of course we have these oligarchs who are cooperating directly or indirectly with the Kremlin and of course fueling this war. So this is how it looks like. And I think all of this, and this is a very clear and very powerful message to Ukraine, to Europe, that has been so badly dependent on Russian, especially gas and fossils, right? And globally too, that the energy transition has to be speeded up as quickly as possible. And even though, and I know many always argue that, well, yes, you of course you switch to renewables, but then to have, wind turbines running, solar panels, you need these critical minerals and so on. So that also creates inequalities around the world. Of course, that does. So that is, but this is still another level, I think, of dependencies we are talking about, because once you have a wind turbine in place or solar panels, they work for decades and you don't need this fuel. You're not dependent on purchasing constantly and paying millions and millions in fuel to countries like Russia, who then uses this money to militarize itself and then to start the aggression and the war like it did against Ukraine. And so again, this is important as something to remember, and hopefully the European Union would understand. And now as we are talking about possible ceasefire, and of course Russia is very interested that G7 countries and the European Union would lift the sanctions. The sanctions against Russia and against its fossil fuel exports, they're definitely linked to the need of energy transition. So the sanctions have to stay in place, and God forbid Europe to again reconnect these ties, because then they would worsen the situation and give Russia again the money so that it would again militarize itself even more. And then, of course, well, with a very high chance, start the war then against not just Ukraine, but also the EU. But this is the situation. And there should be reality check on every single step when we deal with countries like Russia.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you very much for bringing this up. Actually, energy security, it is what energy transition now is standing for, because it's no longer like the privilege of us to phase out fossil fuels, but it's the only way we can ensure the security of European continent and ensure that we can supply ourselves with the resilient source of energy and like actually source of life to a certain extent. And Svetlana, Anya mentioned that it was you in 2022 who clearly and outspoke spoke out loud about that it is the fossil fuels that is fueling the war in Ukraine. Can you tell a little bit more how it happened? And can you share like how you came up with this direct link and what was the response of the international community to that? Because as far as I remember, you were back then at IPCC like meeting, right? And like it was the momentum when you brought this up.
Yeah, well, actually, it's very, it's very hard, my memories, and it's very bright again, memories from that date, which I was a head of delegation actually of Ukraine to this IPCC meeting, and late in night we actually finalized our previous session, and in the morning I should come to the next session, and the during this, few hours, I thought a lot about the situation. And when you in such situation, your brain works very well. So my brain exactly shows the route of the problem of climate change and roots of as fossil fuel as enabler of this war, of this Russian aggression against Ukraine. And since I was on this meeting, which is expert actually panel on climate change, so I put clear this connection and I really name it like fossil fuel war, that fossil fuel actually make this aggression after all, and they actually make this war for survival in this world. And if we will change our dependency, if we will cut our dependency of these fossil fuels, we will be all free. So it was very clear for me at that moment. And I tried, I guess, this first day very emotionally because, yeah, I was in such a situation to bring it to the panel. And I really got a lot of support from experts from different countries because they clearly understood that it's true. And if we fight against climate change, so we should fight against fossil fuel. And this will give actually sense to climate movements across the globe to fight against climate change and against actually Russian aggression. And not only Russian aggression, because there are other petro dictators, so we call them as petro dictators, who actually possess, who owns their power from fossil fuels. So it was so clear for me that I spoke at this big panel, and I should say that I did the same just few weeks ago, okay, 1 month ago at the moment when it was thought. Let's say third year of the full-scale invasion, I was again at the IPCC panel and I spoke again and I told all representatives that we're still in this war, which fueled with fossil fuels. And we have additional emissions from this war, which is 230 million tons equivalent CO2, which actually combined annual emissions of such countries, such European countries as Austria, Hungary, Czech Republic, and Slovakia. So it's huge additional emissions to our mutual total carbon budget, actually. So it means that this war is not local conflict, how it's try to represent many countries, but actually has big impact on climate system. So it was really very, let's say, powerful. And well, my mission actually at this meeting was to pay attention to this well, to people and ecosystem under conflict. How it says, I cannot bring war on this big panel, but conflict is enough to speak, because it's not only Russian-Ukrainian war. There are other actually places, unfortunately, on the planet where people and ecosystem suffering from military aggression. So we put it in outline of our future report, and there was conflict and. Actually, one country insists that we put their fight for resources as well. So again, so we go to these critical minerals, which really critical. And for Working Group 3, I should to convince some countries that we spoke about conflict as this additional emissions, not as a cause of conflict, which could be, in fact, but it's topic of other UN body, let's say, it's Security Council about this war. But in this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, it's very relevant because we have these additional emissions, these military emissions, which is not accounted at all, any country. And it's huge, actually, let's say, huge exhaust of our mutual carbon budget. So I should say that this green transformation, the same as Anna said, it's way of going not only for sustainability for any countries and for Ukraine, of course. It's about independence and security. So We expand the solar wind, and we didn't speak about bioenergy, which we have a big potential, in fact, in Ukraine about this bioenergy, and a huge potential for green hydrogen production as well in Ukraine, which could turn the country into a key energy supplier for Europe, strengthening both actually economy and our geopolitical standing, which we really need in our Europe, in on the planet actually. So investment in these renewables also mean less reliance on imported fuels. Again, as Anna said about generator, anywhere you need fuel, but for solar and wind we already have this energy in the nature. So this green energy, it's not just a climate solution. It's path to national resilience, economic stability, and true energy sovereignty for any countries, including Ukraine.
Well,
Perhaps
yes.
on the energy sovereignty, it's also this question that we're discussing now in all of the different sectors, from culture to actually here energy. It's about also this aspect of decolonization, because Ukraine has definitely been well, we have to accept the fact that we've been the colony of Russian Empire that still remains an empire. And that it well, it forced its own vision and policies also into Ukraine, and how it's in the kind of infrastructure that Ukraine had with time was bound to what, Moscow wanted to see. And so this dependency on fossil fuel is exactly something that was so strong and that lasted till actually 1st of January this year, when Ukraine stopped the transition of Russian gas through this huge pipe that was going through the whole of Ukraine, right? The transition of Russian gas to Europe that Ukraine was also using at some point, and was consuming a lot of Russian gas, and Russia has been playing on that. So imagine how long this dependency lasts, and how long time it takes to actually break this connection. And also, there is always a threat that this could restart again if we don't do this transition now, if we don't plan it properly, both Ukraine and Europe together. So here the cooperation and synchronization of the policies is crucial and critical.
Yeah, thank you very much. So we could have seen that climate impact of the war is extensive. The environmental devastation from the war is immense, but that there is always an opportunity, and the opportunity to showcase the whole world that energy transition again, it's not a luxury, and that it's something that ensures Ukraine's future independence and security, but as well the Europe's and the global one. And connecting you both, right? Again, the science and the policy. How these two can work together, to create these sustainable solutions and to address post-war recovery in Ukraine, climate resilience in Ukraine, but again, how to marry them, showing the whole world that this is now the priority. Because in Ukraine, we always have this sense of urgency, and this is what is driving the innovation, the what Svetlana mentioned, the green potential of Ukraine, that it's there to serve for Ukraine, but as well to serve for Europe. But how to make the global community amid this geopolitical turbulence, amid Trump, amid all of this, people say that it's a democratic backsliding, but I would say it's referred possibly the green backsliding as well, that the green agenda is no longer the priority, and even in the conversations within the European Union and European Commission, you can have this very subtle feeling, but not that subtle one already, that climate is not on the top, that now we're talking more about defense. So how to make this both, scientifically based argumentation that energy transition and sustainable development cannot be undermined and cannot be pushed down in comparison to other defense agenda and so on. So how to make the world listen to scientists and listen to sensible policymakers that are still advocating for the sustainable development?
Well, this is a very complicated question, and I don't know if we can answer it because I guess we don't have an answer. In well, the what we see in Ukraine, and again, this is the realities of war, is that speed matters. As quickly the decision can be taken should be taken, because it's a matter of sometimes seconds, minutes, hours, but very short period of time when you have to take quick decisions in order to just move on to the next well, levels, discussions, and so on. And when speed matters more than anything else, it's of course very complicated to make sure that decisions which are taken, they are science-based, the targets which we set now, they are science-based. And that we also in general include all of the stakeholders into the conversation about the political and policy decisions which are being taken. Most of the time, again, because the decisions have to be taken quickly, it's political decisions. At the same time, it's in the end for whatever big important targets or the direction, it is a political decision. So there has to be this political will, and someone in the end has to take this responsibility for the final target and so on. I think we still we do see when we talk about Ukraine's climate targets and climate strategies, we do see participation of scientists in these conversations. However, again, the time is very often limited, so everything is squeezed into, a few months here, a few weeks here, and then the decision has to be taken. So I think it's hard now. And then even if we imagine that the hot phase of the war is well stop somewhere next year or in any time soon, it would be very complicated to kind of accept this new reality, and I think we'll still be moving on like by inertia. And so I'm afraid that once Yeah, the hot phase of the war is over, we would still be moving by inertia, where the quick political decisions would be taken first and foremost, and then there would be not enough space to be engaging with all of the stakeholders and making sure that again the decisions are also science-based. However, again, this is where Ukraine is, and also considering that the threat coming from Russia would be present for many years to come. So it means that priorities would always be kind of specific. At the same time, I think it's super important that Ukraine establishes good connections with especially when it comes to science, universities, academia, institutions with the EU. We didn't have enough of these connections by now, and we have to make sure that we are cooperating as much as possible, that we are learning from each other, that we have, common programs, and I'm sure that this would help out a lot. It's like an investment in our future, even though we understand that today it may be complicated to establish this, very solid science-based approach for decision makers. We have to aim there for sure with time, and that would only be possible when our science would also strengthen again together with Europe. And it's the same on the policy side, of course, because once we are already on the path, but once we join the EU, we also would have to be, learning from others and see how things happen in the EU and adopting these other approaches. So this is all a matter of time and learning and experience. And I'm quite sure that we would be on a good path there.
Yeah. And actually, I had the privilege of spending so much time here with you in Oxford when you were visiting us. And it was like a number of fantastic conversations with Svetlana when she was sharing like the work that her institute is doing. And on this side, honestly, I'm pretty much confident in what Ukraine's institutes and academia and like real scientists are doing, like for now. And sometimes it's not only us learning from EU, but as well EU learning from us, and not only Europe, like but as well like such a fantastic place as the University of Oxford has a lot like to hear from Ukraine and from Ukraine's experience. And Svetlana, I think that you can elaborate a little bit more on what
you have been doing and like your perspectives on that, how to marry them both in science and policies. But again, like in Ukraine, it's always the challenge of once, like Anya mentioned, that we have this urgency of time and some of the decisions are likely to be taken very fast, and it would be no time to listen not only to scientists but to other stakeholders. But here I'm as well pretty much confident in our civil society, and like again Anya is represented here, like the fantastic like NGO like Eco Action as well, aside of her other hats, but like having elaborated on such a unique platform like Build Ukraine Back Better, like that comprises of the number of NGOs, Ukrainian ones and European ones, that are working on the green reconstruction and recovery of Ukraine. So like I'm pretty much confident in this social group that would be there continuing and checking our policymakers. But of course, there is always the challenge of the policymakers to listen to the scientists, no matter what country we're talking about. So from your perspective, like, what would be the key successes or the key, I don't know, like the key instruments eventually to make them listen to each other?
Well, indeed, it's very, very difficult question. And when we speak about science, unfortunately, what I should say, even when I came to science, it was late 90s, let's say, my chief, she said that most science was stimulated by military operations. So I started with cloud models, and these military operations with icing of aircrafts, actually. So that was the question we tried to solve. And now with this war operation, we see many challenges, which actually we can provide solutions there. And this military operation, actually, they already proved that these batteries, they are much more resilient, just because if you put generator for your, you know, for your military operation, you will be very easily recognized by the enemy. So if you have solar panel, you can judge your drones, and you can actually be you know, much less vulnerable at the front line. So again, we go to these renewables, and I saw many projects which goes to military field, and many military operations now thinking about renewables, powering their drones, not only drones, but some other techniques, let's say, or so they use biofuel, for example. And I saw a NATO report where actually climate change was recognized as a threat for future operations on the land, in the air, and in the sea, in the ocean, in fact, because there are many challenges as well. So again, this they go hand in hand, this climate change and the scientific development, and policy should actually adopt for this, because otherwise the country which will not be so so agile with these changes just will lose in the war and in the world, in fact. So that's why I see that, well, it was both. Before it was military and space. At the moment we don't speak about space, but we know that space is a good stimulus to make scientific innovation as well. Anyway, Ukraine now is a leader. We really show and we really prove how renewables can be more sustainable and more resilient. So when, again, in Mykolaivska Oblast, DTEC built this wind power plant, which is power, you know, instead of this old power plants on coal, which is decentralized, distributed, and you cannot actually kill it with one, you know, ballistic missile. So again, nuclear energy, nuclear power plant, they are so vulnerable in this military operation. Just one missile, and you will lose so many energy again. So we prove what is more resilient and how to go. So now policy should just follow and you know, put it on the paper with a signature, so then we can be sure that it will go in the right direction.
With the signature of somebody who is in charge of defense of the country, right? So it's very
Sure.
interesting angle that like innovation was driven by the military and by the defense first and foremost, and then it ended up in some beneficial like social benefits like that would protect the environment. So possibly we need to frame the environmentalism and like the protection of the environment in this way, that again, the security concern first and foremost. And if the militaries like worldwide are thinking that renewables like are the trustworthy and like really more resilient source of energy, then why not the countries like would take this approach and frame it in this way? And this is a very interesting, like involving conversations, especially taking in consideration like these geopolitical like turbulence and shifts. And thank you very much for bringing this up. And to conclude, because I have this like feeling that we can talk for ages, and it's so many interesting topics and experiences that you can share. The last question is always about hope. So, what gives you hope for Ukraine's environmental future, despite every single challenge you have mentioned and supposedly much more? So, what hopeful perspectives do you have, and what makes you believe that Ukraine and the world will take the right path?
Oh, there is quite a few things that give hope. And I think first and foremost, it's the people of Ukraine who continue fighting for more than 3 years now, this huge invasion, and for more than 11 years now, since 2014, that there's been so many now, fighting for our independence, in fact. So these are fantastic people, and I think especially now, having colleagues who normally work in normal times on environmental policies, who have joined now the armed forces of Ukraine. We have, friends and families and colleagues. I think all of us now have people who have joined the army. Just thinking about them and how much they could have contributed, I think all of us also feel the responsibility that we also have to do as much as we can every single day. Because had they been working with us now, they would have wanted exactly that. So I think people give hope the most, and people who during this again, terrible times when we see so much devastation. They continue doing the research. They continue rebuilding. They continue planning their future because everybody wants to see this light in the end of the tunnel. We have some fantastic communities all around Ukraine who are still now planning their sustainable energy and climate action plans and want to see this better future for themselves, for their kids, and they understand the practical aspects of it. And more communities understand now. So this is one side, and also I always and always keep referring to the Kakhovka Dam disaster, one of the, most terrible environmental disasters that happened in Europe in the last few decades, because the scale of it is really dramatic. But at the same time, we have this forest growing there, just right at the place of the reservoir. The forest that could become a forest only because the seeds were planted exactly within the weeks that when the nature allowed them to grow and to become a forest with time. So there is something, at the level of a miracle that happened in Ukraine. And when you see that, and when you actually have, Ukrainian scientists who go there and they show, and these videos gather already hundreds of thousands of views on YouTube. Ukrainians want to see how this forest is growing there. The scientists who are showing what kind of, biodiversity is developing there, how fantastic it is. Look at this insect here, look at those birds there, and so on. And I think Ukrainians, and you know, even when I talk about it, I have these goosebumps because I think this is something that is really amazing and inspiring. Just, you know, in this devastation, to have this kind of things which are there, and they give hope, because then you see that the nature finds its way back, even through this complicated times, and people are there to appreciate it and to preserve it. So I think these are the fantastic things. There's fantastic people. And also, maybe because we are, you know, we are the Oxford podcast now, and Ukraine, I think Ukraine cooperation has been also fantastic and really, really precious, since, especially since last year's. And then just today, I read that the UK has brought in lots of animals from Ukraine, from the zoos, that were saved also by, you know, that had to be treated, and so they are now in the UK. Hopefully will come back to Ukraine. And this is just, of course, one of small example of this cooperation, but this also gives hopes, because there is people out there beyond just Ukrainians who care, and we of course want to, you know, ourselves and our kids and grandkids to be living in peace and have a good environment. But there is also other people out there who also care, and who support. So yeah, there is just so much more to say, but we'll stop here.
I have had the goosebumps, and I'm sure that the listeners have had them as well. Svetlana.
Well, I can only agree with Anna, because, well, without any doubt, it's our people, but most of all, it's our yours, in fact. So that's my hope. This new generation of Ukrainians who are deeply committed, actually, to building a greener, more sustainable country. And I really often, literally every week, I meet young environmentalists, scientists, activists who are leading local initiatives, from reforesting war-damaged lands to pushing for cleaner air and water. They do fantastic. Sometimes it's you know you I sometimes I even don't believe, but I don't say any word. I just let them go, because these students, they led projects like urban green spaces, plastic recycle, you know, and water conservation in many places. So, I mean, I really feel it. I really feel this mood in our next generation, and they truly inspiring in their unwavering determination to not to rebuild, but renew, to make this renaissance of Ukraine. So make this country leading in the world, in fact. So they want, they really want, and they see the way how to breathe this clean air, drink safe water, and ensure a healthier future for the next generation, for their kids, in fact. So I believe that their passion and resilience are shaping Ukraine's post-war recovery. So they will take all our wisdom, all our knowledge, and they put it on new, you know, new level, I would say, and they will rebuild not only that what was lost, but creating modern and eco-conscious, actually, nation. That's why I believe that Ukraine environmental future is bright. So it's our yours. It's all, actually, it's not only our Ukrainian yours. I met with international community as well. So they have huge support for Ukraine, and they do a lot of work in their environment, in their country, to make it more resilient, more greener, more healthy. So it's, I guess they will. We need just overcome those old men, which which can do, in fact, nothing except stop, trying to stop, let's say. But yours unstoppable, and I believe in this new generation.
The power of the future generations, the crowned, like of the sustainable development for the sake of the future generations, but as well led by the future generations. Thank you so much. Actually, I have had the goosebumps, and I think that this is the most important outcome when these conversations are happening and when they are the one that are giving hope. Thank you both for sharing your important perspectives and sharing you the goosebumps as well. And all of these challenges and opportunities, they are always like come together. And thank you very much for giving us so much to consider about how science and policy can address both the immediate crisis and the long-term sustainability. And to our listeners, this conversation and the part of Pelagia went Ukrainian environmentalism perspectives from science, policy and culture, which also explores cultural or artistic dimensions on Ukraine's relationship with its environment, with the dedicated podcast that would accompany this one as well. This podcast is brought up by the Oxford Ukraine Hub, an interdisciplinary network connecting expertise around and across Oxford University with international researchers and practitioners working on Ukraine's related issues. Thank you for the listeners, but thank you first and foremost for Anna and Svetlana for finding the time and sharing your amazing and hopeful energy.
Thank you for having us, Evgenia.